aliens, and welcome back to Area 51 and a half, where we talk about all things science fiction, fantasy, horror, and pop culture. I am your host, Spooky Uncle John. With me, as always, are my Millennial Falcons.
Snyderman 501, Nick Snyder.
And Pyre Lily, a.k.a. Technomage.
Nick, remind our aliens how they can get a hold of us.
Well, they can find us by searching at the Area 51H on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. You can also find us on Facebook and YouTube by searching for Area 51 and a half. Don't forget to check out our Patreon for all sorts of exclusive goodies and a shout out during our podcast. And also, make sure to take part in our survey to let us know how we are doing. We're looking for your honest and constructive feedback. The link will be in the write-up for the show. Just a reminder, every Monday night, Area 51 and a half will be hosting Games Night at Danny's from 4 to close, right here in St. Thomas, Ontario. Entry is, of course, free with purchase of food, but that's not all. Half-price nachos and mozza sticks are a go. Also, make sure to check out the potato puffs, they are to die for. St. Thomas Danny's is located at 417 Wellington Street at the Elgin Center.
That's always a fun time, and I'm kind of sad that I'm not going to be able to be there.
Oh, yeah, just really sad that you're not going
to
be there.
Well, no, but I am, because like it's, for if you're just tuning in, I have to yeet myself to Toronto, because it's starting to get to close to filming for Guillermo del Toro's Prodigal Father is the working title, which is basically Frankenstein. I am in the background. So probably if you blur or blink, you're going to miss me. So look for me when it comes out, probably in like 2025, but, it's surreal. Oh, it is so surreal.
Yeah. You just got your,
my new look. My new look.
For the aliens who haven't seen him, Spooky Uncle John is rocking the Lemmy and it looks good. It is. Lemmy Kilmister, the lead singer from Motorhead, yeah. Has this. This is the facial hair.
Here's the thing. Here's what happened. So when I was chosen, it was a preliminary choosing. This is all the history of it. Preliminary choosing. So it's like, great. Director's choice. Great. Guillermo del Toro chooses me. Yay, amongst other, of course. So they tell you to grow your beard out. So I grew my beard out. Continued to grow it out. And then we get a call to do fittings for costume. So I yeeted myself to Toronto, did the fitting for costume, yeeted myself home. Then we got a call for hair and makeup. So I yeeted myself to Toronto and did hair and makeup. And it was so much fun because I've done background before, but this is completely different.
Yeah.
Because this is like a big Hollywood kind of production, right? Like not that the other ones weren't. But in the other ones that I've done, it's like, it's a location. And so you go to the location. It's like, yeah, you got to meet the costumer here. And you say, bring the following items for yourself to wear.
Oh, okay.
So you're bringing your own clothes. Mm-hmm. No, this is a period piece. So it's like, nobody has this. So what was really fun is I had a great time with all like the hair and makeup people and the costume people. But the lady that was doing the shaping of the beard and mustache. So it's a mustache goes into mutton chops is what it is. It was so much fun working with her because she had a really, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but she had a real pretension in the way she spoke because she had an Irish accent to begin with. But she would look in the mirror and she was very serious about everything. She's like, yes. You've quite a distinguished face.
And, that's a word.
And then she would go on. She's like, yes, yes. This look belongs with you. You know, it's just
this look. Oh. Honestly, I agree with her. This look belongs with you.
No, with the hat off, this look does not belong with me. With the hat on, the cowboyish hat, it does belong with me. And I have to thank my friend Lee Molson for the suggestion because when I first put it on Facebook, it's like, well, this is what they did to me. And I'm just like, I felt like I needed to start a barbershop quartet with Aaron Walpole. And Lee's like, no. Lemmy. And I'm like, yeah. I have those items in my wardrobe. I can do that.
It definitely reminds me of Civil War soldier.
Yeah.
Like that's,
yeah. Yeah, a little bit, but like Southern Civil War soldiers.
They all had the same hairstyles. Yeah. Come on. But the beard was a lot better than the Gettysburg movie.
I'll tell you what was cool was the fact that when I went for hair and makeup, by this time, base camp has been set up.
Ooh.
So you can't park at the studio. You have to park elsewhere and they shuttle you.
Mm-hmm.
So I get shuttled and I'm looking around, and here's the thing, like, Toronto is such an urban jungle that when you're out there, sort of in what you would call the sticks, I guess, in a way, like, there was nothing around it. And, like, there's this old factory. I don't know if it was still working or whatever, but, you know, there's this old factory that looks like the Creeper's lair.
Yeah.
Nobody is around, and I'm just like, if I don't make it home, tell my mother I love her. But it was funny because the GPS took me to the address, mm-hmm. but you don't see that there's this parking lot over here
mm-hmm.
and whatever this big industrial building is. This old guy comes out like the Harbinger in a horror movie because like he's got like the facial hair and he's got like white hair and it's a retirement job because living in Toronto's expensive, and he comes waddling out of the security building, and I rolled down my window and I said, I'm here to park to get shuttled to the movie studio. Not here, you ain't. And I'm just like it's over there. You gotta go around here and over the tracks. And I'm just like, okay, thanks, Pops.
At any point did he say the parking lot has a blood curse on it?
Because
I was half expecting it. But this is the cool part. So the shuttle finally shows up. It's an old school bus.
Of course.
Of course. Nothing but the finest. It's an old school bus. And I'm there with a crew member, and we get on the school bus, and off we go. The driver thought I was also a crew member on a break. And so we drove to the studio proper, and I got to see the huge set that I can't really tell anybody about.
No.
And I was sitting there going, pulling out the camera, going, no, can't do that. Oh. Can't do that. Because I don't want to lose this gig. But I was just like, wow. So I can't tell you what it's about, because I don't want to freeze myself out of the situation and get, mm-hmm. you know, maybe banished to the North Pole or anything like that. So yeah, I can't tell you about it. But I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm leaving tomorrow.
But not on a jet plane.
I wish it was on a jet plane because it would be a lot faster. Oh my God. Got stuck in traffic for an hour and I'm like, I can see the ramp. Yep. Right? It's like right there.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. But you know what? Toronto's an amazing city. Just the traffic sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on that note, it's time for Nick's Pop Culture Roundup.
What was once known as Superman Legacy and now simply Superman has begun filming.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Right. James Gunn took to social media to share the first look at the iconic S that adorns Superman's chest. We actually have a picture of it up right now looking at it. It's covered in snow or really bad dandruff. Can't really tell.
I'm assuming that is Hollywood snow.
Definitely snow.
I'm definitely thinking it's...
as long as it's not asbestos.
This is Superman, not Wizard of Oz. Anyway, it looks classic. One really interesting thing. This is actually the first live-action film to simply be called Superman.
You're right, because the first one was Superman the movie.
Yeah, so that's interesting. This is clearly, it's clearly snow. It's clearly Fortress of Solitude, obviously.
Possibly.
I'm looking forward to it. I saw...
Could be a crossover into Frozen Empire. We don't know.
We don't know. They also posted a selfie of... James Gunn posted a selfie of him with the cast. It's a good looking cast. Rachel Brosnahan is Lois Lane. Nathan Fillion is Guy Gardner, which I'm really interested in seeing. And was it David Cornsweet, the guy that played the projectionist in Pearl?
Oh,
is
okay.
Superman.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm going to have to take another look at Pearl and check that out because I'm trying to envision him. Can't quite do it.
I think he's a good choice. He definitely has the Clark Kent look to him. And, well, that's not a far jump from having the Superman look. So.
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, I know that there's a lot of people who are still kind of sad about the wiping of the slate without Gal Gadot and Henry Cavill and such. But we'll wait and see.
Yeah, yeah. That's a case of it is what it is. Warner Brothers has made their decision. And that's all there is to it.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a lot I could say about Warner Brothers right now that I'm just not going to. Another first look we have is Tron Ares.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a spectacular looking picture.
It really is. I'm still not sure if it's ignoring Legacy or not, but basically it stars Jared Leto, Cameron Monaghan, Gillian Anderson, and Greta Lee are in it too. It's going to be directed by Joaquin Ronin, who also directed Maleficent and The Last Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm right. Like, I saw you roll your eyes. I'm kind of there with you, but this looks good. Just this picture looks good.
It has Spy Kids 3D vibes.
Really?
I like that. I like that. It looks really cool.
Really?
Yeah, okay. All right.
It definitely has Spy Kids 3D vibes. I'm sorry.
See, this is so hard for me because Tron came out when I was still a kid in the 1980s. I wasn't like a full-on teenager. And it was really a groundbreaking movie. It was Disney Imagineering and Disney special effects leading the way. It was really quite a wonderful picture. Nothing like it had been done before. It's kind of one of the very earliest kind of computer animation kind of special effects that were done. So now, of course, leaping forward into 2024, and the special effects are just miles ahead of where we once were. So I love the Tron series. And I can't wait for this third installment. I think I'm hoping it's going to be good.
This must be a sign for me to make an LED lit outfit to, you know, do some Tron stuff.
It's a sign.
Because it looks really good. And two, who are they going to get to do the music? That's my biggest concern.
That's an interest, because Daft Punk did the music for the last one, and honestly, it's one of my favorite soundtracks to a film.
And that's because it's Daft Punk, and they're amazing.
Yes. I haven't seen anything announced yet, but we'll see what happens. I grew up on the original Tron, literally. Like, that was one of the movies that, dating myself here, obviously, but I would put the VHS in on, I would rewind it and rewatch it and rewind it. I love the original Tron. I actually really liked Legacy. I thought, other than the really ganky de-aging that they did on Clue, it was a really, really good movie. The effects were fantastic. And,
you know, you actually make a really good point with that, because here's kind of the problem. It's not so much the de-aging. It's the fact that because special effects are going in a different way, because everything goes leaps and bounds, because it's all like sort of computer generated, when you look back at films that were made decade, maybe two decades ago, you go, oh, I remember that being so much more impressive at the time. But looking back now, ooh.
Yeah. Like, I remember really, really good, but also really bad example is that first Scooby-Doo movie. When we see the I don't know what else to call them, but the giant rabbit demon monsters from that movie. I remember when the movie came out thinking, oh, that's not too bad. But now looking back, it's terrible. It looks god-awful.
I was thinking more like Spawn with
Spawn didn't look good when it came out.
I know, but...
But here's the thing, though. There are movies that use CGI that's from now a 30-year-old movie that still looks good. Jurassic Park. But yeah. They also used the CGI sparingly and mixed it in with practical effects.
Yeah.
Like, the CGI in Jurassic Park looks better than the CGI in Jurassic World, and that's...
Yeah, and I would also say that Star Wars The Phantom Menace is one that I would choose where I don't think it looked good at when it came out, and it looks even worse now. That's my personal opinion. Don't come for me, Star Wars fans. Please don't come for me.
That's one of the big issues that people are having right now with the new Fantastic Four that's going to be coming out, especially what the one actor said about practical effects, because...
I have a lot of really nasty things I'd like to say about him.
Well, but they're doing CGI for the thing. And because it's easier to move in than a full-on bodysuit, because the practical effects would be amateur. Is what almost... That's not the exact quote, but he did say they were amateur.
Listen, for all the problems that the original Fantastic Four had, I thought Michael Chiklis as the thing, and that was makeup... Looked pretty good.
Well, he did. As people pointed out, cosplayers make far more elaborate outfits than what anything Hollywood can put out.
I want to give that bit of primer there. He didn't say it would look amateur. He said it would look like cosplay and insinuated.
No, he called it amateur.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he didn't.
Yeah, yes. He did. So that's why I want to say some nasty things.
He really has... I think what he's thinking... I saw this video, a reel, if you will. Where these guys are dressed up like ghetto Avengers. Like, it's really very homemade and childish. I think that's what he thinks cosplay is.
Yeah, but...
It's not. The when you get into the upper echelons of cosplay, to Ren's point, those people could be working as costumers in Hollywood, and maybe should be.
There's been a lot of stuff, and it's a whole other conversation... That has to do with makeup and costume and cosplay. But there's been a lot of things that have come out recently that it's like, well, literally cosplayers can do it better. They wear it for just as long as the actors do. And they do it. They put it on half the time with just themselves. And that's a whole other conversation. But
here's the point. Here's the point. Why tick off your fan base?
That's the thing. Like, this guy has just lit up a good portion of the fan base. Like, I'm surprised that there aren't a bunch of cosplayers with pitchforks at Disney going, "We want this guy's head."
Listen, man, at the end of the day, it's an opinion. But just because you have an opinion doesn't mean you need to express it. Let's move on.
All right, and finally on our first looks for this segment, we have The Crow. Ay, ay, ay. Okay, so let's start off with the fact that the original Crow is the most 90s gothic movie that ever 90s'd.
And highly revered.
Highly, highly. Now, I made a post about this on our Facebook page. I enjoyed the original Crow movie. Mm-hmm. I don't revere it as much as some of my friends do, as some of my contemporaries do. But I enjoyed it to an extent. I enjoyed all the straight-to-DVD, VHS sequels, all that stuff. And there is a certain look.
You might be alone in that.
So we've seen Bill Skarsgård as Eric Draven. It does not look like what we would expect Eric Draven to look like. He doesn't look good. He looks like the Joker, but like Jared Leto's Joker, but goth and terrible. I have heard one of my favorites was he looks like the type of guy that would sell crack next to an elementary school. Some people have compared him to Machine Gun Kelly. It's not a great look.
No, I'm not loving the look. I mean, not for The Crow. In another movie, sure, maybe.
Yeah. Like, Eric Draven is like, supposed to be a gothic icon with the white face paint and the black eyes. It's something that even the pro wrestler Sting aped as well for his look for a long, long time. This, it just, I don't know. Like, I'm going to reserve judgment until I see it, because I will see this. I love Bill Skarsgård. I think he's fantastic. But this is just not grabbing me in the way that it should. Because they should be doing something to not only bring in the old fans that want to see this movie, but bring in new fans. And all they've done with this is scare off the old fans, because this doesn't look right. And with the new fans, it's just giving them stuff to make fun of.
Listen, I'm going to say something to our younger listeners that, again, don't come for me, because I didn't think it was going to happen, but it does. I'm warning you right now. As you get older, you start caring less about this stuff. And I'll tell you why. Because you've seen it all. You know, you've seen the plot a dozen times in a dozen movies, sometimes better than the one you're watching, sometimes worse. And that's why I've been railing about, give me something new. Give me something new. This is just a repaint and not a good one.
Not a good one.
No. Not a good one. Now, mind you, we've been fooled before where maybe the movie is a lot better than than we think it's going to be right now.
Yeah.
We can't really judge until we've seen it. And even at the end of the day, that boils down to our opinions.
Yeah. Right now, as it stands, it's not garnering the right type of attention, but we'll see how things pan out.
Right. But, you know, sometimes I think that maybe that's sort of the sad part about the internet, is that we get so much information and we get maybe too much information. And so they go beyond whetting our appetites to us looking at it and going, you know, that fish looks off. I don't think I'm going to partake of that.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah.
Well, speaking of cold fish, I have had a really great opportunity to watch a couple revival series. Okay, so the first one I want to talk about is Frasier. Frasier is back on Paramount Plus. Mm-hmm. All right, Frasier has moved to Boston unintentionally. Moved back to Boston, where he's trying to reconnect with his son, Freddie. Okay, now, are they hitting the same notes as the original Frasier series? Not by a long shot. Not by a long shot. But is it fun to watch? Yes, it is. It still has kind of that dynamic because things have kind of flipped a little bit.
Mm.
And the fact that Freddie has moved in with Frasier, so Frasier's now a version of Martin. And,
oh, yep.
And Freddie's sort of a version of Frasier, but a very different version. And the fact that Freddie did not become what Frasier and Lilith would have thought Freddie was going to become.
Mm.
Freddie has become a workaday blue collar worker. He's a firefighter. So it's really kind of an interesting dynamic that way. But the audience went wild when Lilith showed up in one of the episodes. Oh my God, it was so fantastic. Bebe Neuwirth has not lost one bit of her Rapier Witten delivery.
Well, no.
Oh, it was so wonderful watching them play ping pong together once again. You know, and I don't know where the series is going, because this is the weird thing about the character of Frasier Crane.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing, Cheers isn't about Cheers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Frasier
and
his entire lifespan.
Yeah.
You know?
They haven't tried to remake Cheers at all.
No.
They're doing more Frasier.
But here's the nice thing about it. This is what I wanted to really bring in. In the very first episode, at the end of it, they do this nice tribute to John Mahoney, who passed away. And he gets this, because that was the whole start of it, was the fact that Frasier wanted to confront Freddie because Freddie didn't go to Martin's funeral.
Oh.
You know, and so that starts the whole kind of ball rolling.
Okay.
But it was this lovely tribute and send off to that beloved character.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I want to talk about is the Connors. Beverly, played by Estelle Harris, Academy Award winner Estelle Harris, best supporting actress for Bonnie and Clyde.
Okay.
Played Roseanne and Jackie's mother. And there was all these sort of allegations of emotional distance and abuse and so forth and so on. So her character, Bev, has a form of dementia. They try on this new medication and she gets clearer and better. So she has this day out with Jackie. Mm-hmm. What's beautiful about the writing of this is that it made this nice, wonderful moment where she gets to apologize to Jackie for the way she treated her. And they make this wonderful connection and they give Bev this marvelous send off where she says, I don't know when my dementia is going to come back. Mm-hmm. So I am going on this train. I'm going on an adventure. Peace out. Hmm. Peace out. Here's my money. Here's your inheritance. Here's everything. I'm just peacing out. And that's how I want to live my life, however that turns out. And so you get that wonderful closure. And it's like to see that in these things, that's why revival TV series sometimes are wonderful. Mm-hmm. Because it answers questions that we had.
Ties up the loose ends.
And then sometimes they just make more questions.
Yes, but
thanks, Gilmore Girls.
And speaking of revivals, I feel that our main topic is something we've already done. I love when I can make him do that. I love when I can make him roll his eyes.
Oh, it's so great.
Feels fresh. Feels like a couple seasons ago we had been there and done that.
They added some extra spice to it.
We're going
to
dune it again.
I'm leaving. You haven't even seen the movie. You two can do this by yourself. I'm out.
But we want to welcome a special guest to the landing pad. And you know what, Ren? I'm going to let you welcome this special guest because you have a connection to our guest.
We are welcoming the Minstrel Boy, or Grenzer 7, or my dad, the person who taught me how to be a nerd. He is a big fan of Dune.
Touch out, he's a fork and spoon, too, but that's not his fork.
Yeah. And tie your shoes and ride a bike and all the life skills you now have.
Not the bike.
No, not the bike.
So anyway, he's a big Dune fan. He's read a bunch of the books. He has the whole, all four books.
There's about seven books.
Four out of the seven. Has the Dune encyclopedia. So we thought we'd bring him in because he went to go see Dune with Nick and Spooky Uncle John last night.
Please welcome John Goldsworthy to the Area 51 and a half landing pad.
Yay!
Hello, folks. Good to be here.
Good to have you.
Well, nice. The three of us.
And I brought my book.
Oh, we're doing some ASMR on this one. Awesome.
Yeah. The three of us went to see Dune 2, directed by Denis Villeneuve, directed by the legendary Alan Smithee.
Yeah.
Who directed the first one. Just a little background on Alan Smithee, so people will know. Alan Smithee is an official pseudonym used by film directors who wish to disown a project, as David Lynch did.
I didn't realize he Smithied it. That's
hilarious. Now, the reason for that, though, isn't always that they think it's bad. It's just that there's always studio interference. Alan Smithee has been a director. He's been an actor. He's been a playwright. He's been a screenwriter. Whenever somebody has had
a multi-talented personality.
Yes. Whenever they want to disown it, they used Alan Smithee as a pseudonym, and that has now been retired by the Directors Guild. Anyway, that's back in the 1980s. We are talking about 2024 Dune.
Yeah. So we did get to go see it last night. My first thoughts on it. What a banger of a movie. It had me from the get-go. I was on the edge of my seat for the vast majority of it. I adored this film. And I think part of it is it was definitely something that needed to be seen in theater. When you and I, John, saw the first one, we didn't get to see it in the theater.
Yeah, it had to do with the pandemic, actually. Yeah,
and I think that was one of the... That took away from our criticism of it, because this is definitely a series that needs to be seen in the theater.
It was a downfall, not seeing the first Dune on the big screen.
Yeah. Yeah, but this one, I thought it was great. Denis Villeneuve has an amazing eye for visuals. Everything. When we see the planet Harkonnen. When they're out in the sun, it's completely chromatic. It's all black and white, and it looks very, very visually stunning, very striking, very honestly scary. When we go from day to night as well, it kind of hurt when they were going from day to night, because honestly, it would. When you're going from an indoor setting to an outdoor setting on Arrakis, on Dune, it would hurt. And just your eyes adjusting to it hurt. But yeah, I loved it. And I can't wait to see it again.
There's a lot of emotion in this movie.
Yeah, there is.
There's a lot of exposition.
Yeah.
It's very talkative. And I think that one thing I'm going to... Well, let me start this way. Visually, this is a stunning piece of art.
Yeah.
It is beautifully crafted. Mm-hmm. It is amazingly acted, especially by people that you wouldn't necessarily think have those kind of chops. There was that one scene with Dave Bautista particularly, where he is just venomously ticked right off because of the failures of, and he just bangs that guy's head into the
console. I know, right?
It was an astounding piece that I just sat there and went, Bautista is now just an upper echelon actor, in my opinion.
He is so good. And that's it. Like the performances, Austin Butler as Fade Wraitha, he was frightening.
Listen, I am a child at heart. I'm so sorry to do this. I'm such a child at heart. I can't help myself. Because Austin Butler, now he's gonna rise. Like he's there. He's an A-lister already. But because he most recently played Elvis,
yeah,
I couldn't help myself. You probably didn't hear me because I just did it very quietly because I knew you and John were so into the movie. But as soon as he leaves the arena, and I was waiting for it, and I just sat there and went, Elvis has left the building.
Well, I mean, to be fair, there were two parts. There were two very minor parts that took me out for a second. One was one of the line deliveries by Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica. It just encroached on that Saturday morning villain-esque type of delivery. And I'm just like, but whatever, it was fine. But another part that took me out was when we see Stilgar writing the worm for the first time, because the first thing he's very casually doing, the first thing that popped into my head was get around, round, round, I get around. But
all of a sudden, John, we're doing Mystery Science Theater 2000.
That's right.
So, as someone who read the books, did the movie come across as how you imagined it possibly being?
In many ways, it did.
Okay.
I have to say something about the director's view of visuals. The first Dune, which the one that's been denied, I always took it that you were looking through a portal about half a meter wide. That's all you could see. Just looking through this portal and watching, because everything was cramped. Everything was tight.
Right.
That's like the one that was made a while ago with Patrick Stewart and all kinds. Okay.
Patrick Stewart and all those, that crowd. And it was very tight, very cramped. This one, it was as if you're in an open field and the screen was just, I'm holding my arms out to full length for you folks listening.
Yeah. It was a fish this big. It was
this wide.
Yeah.
It was just as broad as could be. A lot of the things in it were better than I imagined. First of all, the mode of transport, the ornithopters. The ornithopter used in the first Dune movie was like a little caboose that flew around. Whereas in this case, there were actual ornithopters, which is a flying vehicle that uses flapping wings like an insect.
Yeah.
And they were just, in my mind, it was right on it.
Yeah, and visually it reminds you of a dragonfly.
Yes, exactly right, yeah. With the four sets of wings. And I thought that was perfectly done. The fighting in the first one, it was a lot of shooting and things like that, and very little sword play. In the book, everything is sword play. So much of it, because the idea that if you shoot a laser gun, into a shield generator, it destroys both the laser gun and the shield generator and everything around them. So, and that was another thing. So everything was knife work, knives and actually daggers and swords, and that was well put across. The depiction of the shield generators was so much better than the than the first. You know, oh look, I'm wearing a glowing refrigerator on my body.
Do you think that has to do with it being a Hollywood level movie compared to like a smaller film, or does it just have to do with the director maybe looking more at the like at the source material?
I think it's parts of the source material, possibly as well the advancement of
CGI technology,
visual effects.
Yeah, because the first Dune in the 80s, it was actually a big movie. It was billed as a big movie.
It was a massive movie.
To be honest, I would not have thought it was.
I did not watch the TV series of Dune. There was a TV series of Dune, which I was told by some people who I trust, but I have no knowledge of it, that it was even more abysmal than the first movie. But be that as it may, I haven't seen it. I can't actually compare it. A number of things were really, really very well done. In my mind, the Sardaukar, the Emperor's fanatic soldiers, were pretty well done, I thought. However, they made a lot of wearing armor, which doesn't take place in the book. But they do use these, they're called suspensors.
Right.
Which allowed them not to fly, but to jump and dive and things like that. And of course, the Baron is wearing these suspensors tucked under the fat rolls of his body so that he can actually stand up and move around.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I really enjoyed about this particular version, Villeneuve's version in the two parts, was the Baron compared to the 80s movie, where it felt like there was a lot of heft to the man. And the floating of the propulsion system, whatever he uses, those, let's call them balloons for lack of better term, really seemed visually a lot more weighty than in the 1980s.
Yes. He was carrying a lot of weight. There was that thing floating around behind him, which they never explained, but I was taking that to be a suspensor boy.
Yeah.
And it did from there. There were some things in it that were over the top. Fade Reuther's cannibal family, that, you know, the women that were around with him who were actually cannibals, that doesn't appear in the book.
Right.
But Fade Reuther has to deal with stuff in the book that don't even show there. At one point, and take this for what it's worth, at one point they take the Baron is homosexual completely. And he takes great joy in raping of young boys. And at one point in the book, he kills the young boy who he's taking advantage of, because they find a poison needle tucked into the boy's thigh where the Baron would put his hand. Because of this, he calls in Fade Reuther, who apparently was behind this. There's all these hugely Byzantine types of betrayal. And Fade Reuther decides he better cut his losses and do whatever his uncle decides. And he says, well, you were spending your time in the women's area of the palace, kind of almost like a harem. And he says, all right, now as your punishment, go in and kill all the women. So he has to go and do that. So he's crude in his own way, but he's not as vilely psychotic as the present movie makes him out to be. And that guy was incredibly scary, because it looked like he didn't have a hair on his body.
Yeah. You know, I think that he almost had to be that because of the size difference between Austin Butler and Dave Bautista.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that you had to have this sort of sleek, vicious, psychotic killing machine versus this tank of a person whose arc is really interesting, because you see that cowardice that comes out of him in one of the battles. And then there's just that wonderful scene and, you know, spoiler alert, where he makes him kiss his foot. It's just, it's so well acted and so well done. And just this idea of a person of power and having physical strength and a physicality and being intimidating also can be intimidated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They made a minor point of the huge breeding schemes of the Bene Gesserit. When you realize that originally the Bene Gesserit had told Jessica, the concubine of Leto Atreides, to have a female child. Apparently they could control what gender child they would have. Because then that child would be bred with Fade Rotha Harkonnen, and they would get the Kwisatz Haderach, which from a Jewish friend of mine translates as the shortening of the way.
Mm.
That's what that exactly means. But she loved Leto and gave him a child, which is Paul. What they don't take note of is that Jessica is the child of the Harkonnen anyway. And so that in this sense, Paul is the high point of that whole breeding cycle without them knowing it.
Right.
Because the Atreides had a child with a Harkonnen leading to him.
Yeah. It's interesting that you're touching on this because there's a lot of recurring themes within Dune, multiple ones. One of them, of course, being religion and fanaticism and prophecies being fulfilled and maybe people jigsaw puzzling pieces into make the prophecy fit.
Yeah.
You know?
Still, like Stilgar. Stilgar, like that was one of his main things. He would see something and go, prophecy!
Yeah.
And actually what that happens in the book, in the movie they made this thing between the northern tribes of Fremen and the southern tribes were seen as, the southerns were seen as fundamentalists. The northerners were like, no, we don't have to do that. In the book, they're all like that.
Right.
The entire Fremen population is subject to this missionaria protectiva legends that were seeded there by the Bene Gesserit.
Right.
And the Bene Gesserit don't believe anything like that is going to happen. It's all done so that they can control people. But their own schemes lead to them being out of control.
Right.
But with Paul cannot be controlled by them.
Yeah. So. And it really gave this wonderful dynamic between Paul and Johnny, where she's looking at this man that she has fallen in love with, that cares deeply for, sort of rise up and become this messiah-like figure that she is not buying into by any stretch of the imagination. And the politics that go along with it that break her heart, and I thought Zendaya did an excellent job in portraying that, because they don't give her dialogue to portray it. So it's all done in her face in that moment when she walks out and she's standing on the dunes of the desert, and it's just a beautiful dynamic in
that way. That's not how the book ends.
Yeah,
the book ends, I brought the book here just because I thought of it. They ask her, Jessica nodded, feeling suddenly old and tired. She looked at Chani, and for the royal concubine, no title for me, Chani whispered, nothing, I beg of you. Paul stared down into her eyes, remembering her suddenly as she stood once with little Leto in her arms. There's a child that is not mentioned. She had a child by Paul who was killed by the Sardaukar.
Right.
And he says, so you say, Chani says, she glanced across the room at the tall princess. Jessica says, we must obey the forms, yet the princess shall have no more than of me than my name, no child of mine, nor touch, nor softness of glance, or an instant of desire. So you say now, Chani said. She glanced across the room at the tall princess. Do you know so little of my son? Jessica whispered. See that princess standing there so haughty and confident? They say she has the pretensions of a literary nature. Let us hope she finds solace in such things. She'll have little else. Think on it, Chani. That princess will have the name, but she'll live as less than a concubine, never to know the moment of tenderness from the man to whom she's bound. While we, Chani, we who have the name of concubine, history will call us wives. And that's where the first book ends.
Right.
So she may not believe what she says. The movie kind of made it that she doesn't believe that Paul is what he's become, and she walks away from that.
Yeah.
In the book, she remains his concubine, his his right. woman for all time and ends up having two more children by him in the next book of the, called Dune Messiah and then the Children of Dune.
Right.
But Dune is one of the most complicated pieces of science fiction literature ever to come out.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, it's not really for everybody, is it? Oh, I mean, this is a case where you either love it or you hate it. It's a case of you either love it or you don't understand it.
Well, even if you love it, you don't understand
yeah.
it. Because there's the Bene Gesserit, you've got the, they don't even bring up the other Benes.
Right.
Because there's, they in the first movie, they had that scene where they brought that big locomotive in and the warped, the mutated steersman comes right. forward, breathing on some spice gas. That doesn't appear in Dune. That appears in Dune Messiah as a flashback. Right. But what you do realize is that, and they did it pretty well. The Emperor is afraid of the Atreides because they're better than he is. And even though they have a small army, they trained them to be as good or not or better than the Sardaukar. The Sardaukar just like to kill things. That's their whole way of being. That's what they want to do. But they realized that he was using the Harkonnens. The Harkonnens thought they were using the Emperor. The Emperor is using the Harkonnens to kill off the Atreides and to give it back, give the land, the planet back to the Harkonnens. What they don't have in any of the movies, and it's only alluded to in the book, is that between the Atreides taking over Arrakis and the Battle of Arrakis when the Harkonnens fight back, there's a massive, massive commando raid where the Atreides have gone and destroyed the entire stockpile of spice that the Harkonnens have put aside. They just wiped it out. So the Harkonnens are broken as far as cash and money goes. That never comes up. But you realize that they had the power to do that. And a couple things they alluded to. That one point where they're firing, that big egg-shaped ship comes down and starts pounding the Sesh Tabir.
Yeah.
He says, oh, yes, we're using artillery. That takes place in the book, but much, much earlier.
Right.
At the end of the battle, the Atreides troops that escape go into these caves, and then the Harkonnens use what we would call high explosive artillery,
right
as we would have it right now, to bomb the caves and destroy them by entombing them there.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you sort of look into these themes of war where you have one entity invading another entity and basically for power because they were after the spice, obviously.
Yes.
And this idea of indigenous people fighting back and religion and corporatism, and there's so many themes going on. It's kind of hard to make sense out of one particular one.
I'm reminded of a scene from the TV show Invincible where Omni-Man says to Invincible, look what they have to do to imitate even a portion of our power. And he's referring to the jet fighters, and Omni-Man is incredibly powerful. And what I mean by that is I look at other works like Game of Thrones, where you have these intricate storylines in this one book, this one story, and in order for it to happen in Game of Thrones, it spans multiple books, multiple seasons of television, and it's just nowhere near as tightly packed as Dune is as a story. And it's there's a lot of characters in the book to the point that it's really hard to keep them all the names straight.
You almost have to do a chart like you see who's just, and here's him, this belongs to this house, and I'll go over there.
In the book, there's actually an appendix where they have all the characters.
How many pages is it, John?
Let me look. Appendices.
It's basically as big as a chapter.
It definitely is. From page 4, in this version, page 493 to 535.
Yes.
But they have to explain some of these, because they're using different languages. You know, what's the Paul's name amongst the Fremen is Muad'Dib.
Yeah.
Kangaroo rat.
Yeah.
And they,
the mighty kangaroo
rat. Yeah. The mightiest.
Well, but to them, it was the wise creature of the desert who knew how to do things.
That was actually the one special effect that took me out of the
kangaroo.
Briefly, yeah. It didn't, it looked special effect-y.
Yeah.
What's that?
The little kangaroo rat that pops up.
Yeah, but that's also the name of the moon.
Yeah.
The moon.
No, I was just talking about in terms of the visuals of the movie. That's the one sort of, the other thing that kind of took me out briefly was Christopher Walken as the emperor, simply because Christopher Walken, I mean, these actors have been around forever, right?
Yeah.
He's aging, and all I could do is I could sort of see almost the pain in the actor's eye was where he's sitting there thinking, God, I thought you would let me sit down once in a while.
So how did he do in the movie? Because I know that was a big thing when they came out with he's going to be in it.
Oh, he was fine.
He didn't use his Christopher Walken voice.
Yeah.
He was okay. He was okay.
Yeah. I cannot say that anyone in this film performed poorly.
No, they didn't. And you know, to what I was saying earlier, some of them surprisingly were better than you would have expected.
Yeah.
The guy who played the head of the Fremen, what's his name? Stilgar. When they're getting ready for Paul to ride the worm.
Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
He comes and he goes, oh no, not that one, not one that big.
A grandfather worm.
Yeah, there's this huge worm appears and he goes, well, no, not one that big.
Yeah, but those are the moments I think that directorial-wise were very brilliant. And the fact that because there's so much exposition in this, because there's so much talk, there was a couple of points where I'm like, okay, this 3-hour movie is starting to feel a little like 5 hours.
Yeah.
Because the action is rather spread out, but the visuals are fantastic.
Yeah.
That was a particularly exciting moment because you see that, you feel that sort of threat of this worm being so massive that you go, is he going to survive this? Well, of course, the hero, you know he's going to, but at the same time, you're like,
it was close.
Yeah, he's just like, I don't know about this. And they did that expertly because everybody was sort of like the one faction was joking about it. Chani was not happy about them joking about it. The fanatics are going, this is the Messiah's going to do this. This is the Messiah. The size of that thing, he better damn well be the Messiah. Otherwise, he's not going to survive.
It's just interesting. There's so many things that had to be left out.
Yeah.
Because you just can't include everything.
Yeah.
But at one point, when the emperor lands on Arrakis, which I thought his palace tent kind of thing was really nicely done, much better than that chintzy Trump casino they were using in the first movie. But in the book, they look through the telescopic equipment. What flag is he flying? If he's flying the Atreides flag, that meant he was going to take the side of the Atreides. If he's flying the Harkonnen flag, he's going to take the side of the Harkonnen. Instead, he's flying the flag of the Chong,
right?
The company that runs the mercantile company that runs the thing. He's flying that, so he says, "I'm going to stand on the side of the prophet."
Yeah.
PROFIT, whatever the profit's going to be.
Follow the money.
Exactly. And in the end of the book, they said, what's going to happen to the emperor? He says he'll be utterly stripped. He can go back to his planet, which originally was a hellhole where they would train the Sardaukar in this hellhole. He says it'll become a place of a gentle place of springs and forests. It's like, oh my God, he's going to take the Sardaukar away from me, which he was going to do. He says he's also going to be stripped of all his holdings, and all of the Choam, Chom, holdings of the emperor were to be given to Paul Atreides as his dowry of the wedding. So he was going to be stripped of everything except his title as past emperor, and he's going to live on this planet, Seleucia Secundus, which was originally, like I said, a hellhole, is now going to become a gentle planet. And he's like, oh, I know. He could say, you could even hear it, even though it's not read, the emperor going, that's it. He's taking all my power away, including my military power. He said he'd be able to keep one legion of Sardaukar. He had 50. In the book, when they attack Arrakis with the Harkonnens and the Sardaukar wearing Harkonnen uniforms, in the book, he sent 30 legions of Sardaukar, and a legion is like what would be a modern brigade.
Right.
A massive influx of these soldier fanatics, and it was just like, whoa, you know, how could the Atreides survive it? And they didn't, because they went. In the first movie, they mentioned it and said that we can't use sea power like we use in Caladan. We have to go for desert power. And he does. Paul ends up going to desert power. And another aside, I'm glad they didn't go with that stupid sonic weapon that they did in the first movie, which was absolutely ridiculous. You know, and I never cared for that.
Well, it's interesting because we, in previous episodes of Area 51 and a Half, we've sort of discussed book to movie. And of course, whenever you see a movie, it's based on or inspired by either a true event or based on a movie, or sorry, a book. In the case of The Boogeyman, where I had made the point that it was nothing like the Stephen King short story, they took a small paraphrase of it and used that, and a small bit of the ending and used that, to the point that I thought they had a lot of nerve calling it Stephen King's Boogeyman. How close to the novel is this as an adaptation?
Fairly close. I was discussing this with my wife, and she brought up the idea that they had to make the female character stronger than was originally written, because the book was, when did this book come out?
60s or 70s?
I'm checking.
60s, I think.
First edition, 1965.
Ayo,
yeah.
John.
Copyright 1965. So we're talking, you know, this book is 50 years old.
Yeah.
And on present understanding of things, the female characters had to be stronger. Okay, they had to do it that way. So they changed the end to make Chani's character much stronger under the circumstances.
Right.
Understanding of that way, okay, I can deal with it. Personally, I was disappointed because it didn't follow the route of the thing. When the first movie ended and the rain came down, it's like, don't do that. and little Aaliyah of the knife saying, because he is the Kwisatz Haderach, but nobody told him what the Kwisatz Haderach was.
Yeah, it's interesting that the book came out in 1965, and yet our first adaptation was a good 20 years after the book came out.
Is that the
84?
There was one that was planned 10 years before that,
right,
by a Polish director.
Jodorowsky.
Well, that would have probably
been. And all I've ever seen of that was the costume art. And it was, you thought the costume art was weird in the first movie. This was seven times weirder.
There is a documentary on Jodorowsky's Dune about the ill-fated production. And they go over the whole thing. It's a really in-depth documentary. At one point, it was on Shudder, but I don't think it's on there anymore. Hmm. But yeah, if you ever get a chance to watch it, it's interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's I think that, speaking of this kind of thing, I think having someone like Denis Villeneuve be the director is actually brilliant, because there are these wonderful things that happen when you see, to us, foreign movies with European directors from Poland, from France, from Russia, from Finland, from all of those different places, right? Where they have a sensibility and a way of telling stories that is vastly different from North America.
Yeah.
That I would have liked to maybe have seen that, because I've mentioned it before, and I finally have a copy that I can watch, and I really want to watch On the Silver Globe, which is this post-apocalyptic kind of science fiction world, but from Europe. And just some of the visual effects that they came up with many, many, many years ago. You know, because we always laud George Lucas and Industrial Light and Magic as being the be-all and end-all of it. But when you see a movie like Vi, where the monk has the witch on his shoulders and they're flying through the air, and you sit there and you look at that from the 1960s, and you see it, and you go, that is still a stunning visual effect done back then. You know, and so there's just a richness in the storytelling of it all.
Yeah.
And I think that what I would suggest to anybody who has not seen Dune 2 yet, give Dune a rewatch first, because one of the things that I had trouble with was remembering everything that had happened, not read the book. Yeah. And that's, I think, partly why I was dozing a little bit, because I was like, I don't remember this. This is a lot of speeching and... But what saved it for me, though, is how visually stunning it is.
Now, I intend to read the book again now that I've seen the thing. And I know that the visuals are going to impact this. Like the idea of the Dune factory crawlers being brought in by balloons. I mean, that was an incredible idea. Rather than having some mechanical equipment come in, bring the balloons in, because it just made sense to me.
When did you actually first become in tune with Dune and read the book?
Probably back when I was in university in the mid-1970s.
Right. What attracted you to it?
I was reading all kinds of science fiction. It was one of the ones that was really current at the time. Now,
highly thought about, talked about, regarded.
Yeah. I remember finding out about Dune Messiah when I was borrowing some science fiction magazines from the man from whom I was taking music lessons from in the Nazareth Music Center. And I, Uncle Ralph, you know. And there were things there that I... So it was in the 70s. It was in the 70s that I did that. And it's one of those books that, if you can, I recommend you read. It's not an easy read, but it's well worth it.
Right.
But you're going to have to read it a couple times, because if you imagine a totally amoral Holy Roman Empire, where there's a cynical manipulation of religion by the ruling class, and meeting up with a fanatic religious prophecy and the whole prophecy background of that clashing together in a incredibly far future situation where there are no computers. You know, there's no computers, but there are computers that you're not supposed to know about.
Right.
Because they don't bring it up. They brought it up a little bit in the first movie, because there's the Ixians, who are making machines, although they're forbidden, they make them anyway. And then there's the Bene Tleilaxu, who have these things called face dancers that can change the shape of their face as they move, and they get some really weird stuff.
You know, it's funny that when we look at all the different themes, the religion, the religious fanaticism, the corporate
capitalism,
the corporate invasions, the anti-feminist movements, and all that kind of stuff.
And just
not plain, much has changed.
just a plain old power politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And
manipulation, right?
Yeah.
So just to kind of give final thoughts, if you had to pick one scene in the movie that you would just, that will stick with you, what would it be?
Nick, how about you first?
When we first meet Fade Raitha and he's given the blades, and he just kills his handmaidens right there without saying a word, just to test them. And then he turns to the guy and says, "Not sharp enough." Like that. That Austin Butler's Fade Raitha is just going to stick with me. He is scary. Frightening.
What about you, John?
Hard to say. What strikes me most is the... In the first movie, the battle in the hallway between the the Harkonnen troopers and the soldiers of the Atreides, and suddenly it's raining Sardaukar behind them. They come in, suspenser dropped behind them, and the guy just yells Sardaukar, and everything goes nuts because they're able to beat the Harkonnen troops, not easily, but suddenly they're faced with these soldier fanatics that are really going to kill them all just for the fun of killing them all. Well, that one struck me, and like I said, the visual that struck me most, bringing the sand crawlers in by balloon.
Yeah.
I still sit there and go, that was incredible.
Yeah. Honestly, with a movie like this, Ren, it's really hard to pick moments like that because it is just a gorgeous piece of art from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you, like Nick mentioned, the visual effects when we're first introduced into the arena where it's very gladiator-like and the planet is black and white and it takes a shift in the art that makes you go, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was jarring.
Let's pay attention to that, you know? And little special effects, like you see the vapor, the heat, when we've seen those really hot summer days where it looks like there's water on the, you know, so all that kind of stuff is very stunning. So it's really hard to pick those moments. But the two things that will always stand out in my mind that's a little bit different, again, the performance by Austin Butler, the introduction to that character is just fantastic. But that whole dynamic, like I mentioned it earlier, where Dave Bautista just shows that he has acting chops and he is furious and he has a lot at stake and he has no qualms about killing like the pilot of the craft.
Violently.
And just because they've ticked him off. And to watch that kind of aggression being played out to the point that you go, how did they do that? And the yin to that yang is the heart of it all, which is Zendaya's performance as Chani, where you see it through her eyes. You see every step of the way where she goes from love to heartache to concern to not really wanting to open herself up to Paul, but she does. And, you know, it's a stunning, stunning thing to watch. She's the heart of the movie, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just kind of, the costuming is amazing. I can't get over the vision of Florence Pugh in that silver lace kind of outfit that she was wearing with the beadwork. Like, it's such a close-up that you go, this is obviously going to be nominated for Best Costumes at next year's Oscars, as well as visual effects, I would imagine. But probably
yet,
even
Best Picture. But yet the costumes were simple.
Yeah, or appeared simple.
In a sense, they came across as simple. They weren't incredibly ornate.
It was organic.
There you go.
Yeah, like you really felt like it belonged in the world.
When you look at Christopher Walken's Emperor, he's not done up like an emperor. Like, he just looks like he's just wearing a robe.
Yeah.
A robe and a tunic.
Yeah, it looks like casual Friday at the office.
Yeah.
But if you're the emperor, you can get away with that.
Yeah. It's good to be the king.
That's the point. That's
at
the
least
point.
Everybody knows now that if you walk without a rhythm, you won't attract a worm.
So. Just want to talk about that for a second. So they show them sand walking in the movie, and I am 100% sure that that is actually one of the dance moves from Weapon of Choice.
Maybe.
With Christopher Walken, where they say it. Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's hilarious.
Well, on that note, Nick, can you remind our aliens how they can get a hold of us one more time?
Oh, you can find us on social media. That is Instagram, Threads, and TikTok at the Area 51H. You can find us on Facebook and YouTube, as well as Patreon, by searching for Area 51.5. And, of course, don't forget to check out our survey.
And if you're in the St. Thomas area, don't forget to come out and join Nick at Denny's for games night.
Yep.
John, thank you for being our guest on this show.
Pleasure.
Think that it definitely added some spice to the episode that we didn't have.
Not too much. Your eyes turn blue.
Yeah, yeah. I have so much knowledge of it, and we really appreciate
that. And by the way, all you listeners, get the book and read it.
The whole series. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Area 51.5. On behalf of myself, Spooky Uncle John, and
Snyderman 501 Nick Snyder.
And Pyre Lily the Technomage.
Thank you for joining us on the landing pad, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Would let me sit down once in a while.